Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. As a college student in the 1960s, Elizabeth Hawes developed a passion for the French writer and philosopher Albert Camus. Her infatuation matured into a 40-year affair of the mind and heart with the author and his work. Over the past decade, she's examined his unpublished journals and letters, interviewed his family and friends, and literally followed in his footsteps. The result is a biography and memoir titled Camus, A Romance. Elizabeth Hawes joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you so much.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. So what first attracted you to Camus?
I think I had read The Stranger in high school.
As have many high school students across the country.
Continue to. I grew up in the Midwest. And it wasn't until college that I did decide to, you know, take on Camus as a thesis for my honors work, and at which point I went deeply into his work. And it was during the course of this that I became more and more involved with the man as well as the work.
And was it different from your attraction to other writers or your admiration for other authors?
Well, there is something about Camus, and Susan Sontag said in a famous essay that, you know, other writers, you know, invoke, you know, followings and inspiration, give you inspiration, and you respect them, but it's only Camus of all the modern writers she could think of, made you love him. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that he does write personally. He writes from experience, and he writes about feelings himself. And it is from these feelings, I think, writers respond. But there is, you know, quite widely a very personal connection with him, which I didn't feel right away. I just felt early on after having read some stuff, I felt like he really was talking to me. And it was a point at which that I was sort of struggling. I was a sophomore. I was not in the least bit sophisticated. I had grown up as a very loyal little, you know, churchgoer and a very good student, very straight. Whatever, and I suddenly was in all this turmoil, throwing away all my beliefs, doing the, you know, the typical thing. And it is when I found Camus and I thought, you know, this guy is writing to me. And I think that's what I think it's a remarkable thing that happens with many writers and readers, in which you're suddenly magnetized into this field. And this person is right, is a private relationship because the thoughts are so directly related to you.
You know, I suppose anyone who writes a biography of an author does that because they find them interesting and worth pursuing. But what's different about your book, Camus, A Romance, is that it's about him, but it is also about you. There's a lot of you in this book and a lot of discussion of your kind of how he affected you, how he interested you, how he frustrated you sometimes.
I think at one point early on, thinking about the nature of biography, which is a fascinating subject just unto itself, I realized that even if you're trying to be the most objective thinker you can, of course it's subjective. You make choices. You have your own experience. You have your own way of approaching something. And I decided I was just going to be subjective about it. And that it was a way to be selective, too. I thought I was going to be much more selective with his life when I began. I thought, I'm not going to get too deeply involved into intellectual politics because it's a really tough subject in France, and maybe I'll go lightly on this and that. And, of course, when you get in there and you're attached to your subject and you're following him around, you have to know why he did this and that, and you find yourself going far afield, getting terribly involved with friends, up to a point where you have to say, no more with René Char. I have to go back to Camus. And those distractions end up on certainly the subject too, which is, again, the nature of biography.
Now, you have been interested in Camus since college, but there was really a point where your interest got revived and you decided to write this book. What prompted you to get kind of reengaged with him?
I had for years thought I probably knew as much as I knew, and of course my life went on. He was just my writer. I had this shelf full of books to prove it, and I felt quite proprietary about them because I knew a lot back, you know, representing the 60s and 70s back then. There are many, many other books that had come out. His journals had come out, which were not available back when I was studying him, so I didn't have that personal voice. As the most personal voice in 1995, his daughter, who had become the executrix 35 years after his death, Fonny decided to release just this fragment of what was meant to be an epic novel, his War and Peace, he said, about the whole 20th century. That was going to be, at the heart of it, was going to be the story of love and the story of French Algeria. And this, of course, was at a point where the Algerian War was raging, and so it became the story of who he was, the story of who his family was, and the story of this country that was about to disappear with independence. Anyway, I read this. I got a hold of it as soon as I heard it was coming out in France, and I got a hold of it. Somebody shipped it to me virtually overnight, and I read it. And as it came out, as he had written it, handwritten, which took him forever to transcribe, it is a very personal, transparently autobiographical, unpublished, i.e. unedited and very forthcoming, story of growing up in dirt poverty in Algiers in, you know, the 1920s, 1910s and 1920s. And it is a very lyric novel, like some of his young novels. It's these very detailed, this illuminated details that, I mean, he writes about poverty in a way as well as anybody I've ever written.
And this book is called?
And this book is called The First Man. And it revived Camus in France. His reputation had been in decline just at the time of his death, and the family had been afraid to release it for the longest time, thinking it would just add to the, you know, the insults that would be piled on him. In America, you don't know all this. I realized, you know, I was reminded as I got further and further into research that he's a very different hero for Americans than he is for French, because Americans don't know about the ups and downs, don't know about the political troubles he got into for hanging in there with his own feelings about Stalinism, for example, where the rest of the intellectual left was certainly hanging in there with Stalin. And it took the end of the Cold War and the opening of the files in Moscow to really make it clear how smart, how wise he was.
Our phone lines are now open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. When you got this renewed interest in Camus with the publication of The First Man in 1995, did you feel that your relationships or your relating to his work was different than it was years before when you had been in college?
I had to be reminded, of course. I mean, it had been 30 years or 40 years or whatever. I had to be reminded of some of the intricacies or some of the things that moved me, and I think different things moved me because I'm older and, you know, more experienced and more appreciative the way you are. But, yes, some things were different, and there was so much more to know about him. You could actually place him in time and place him in a context rather than just intuit from his reading, which is what I did, that how moral a person he was or how lyric or how physical and sensual a person he was. And that all was from his reading, which was very rewarding to be, you know, tracking him and finding out as you went along that he was who you thought he was just from his books.
Now, high school students continue to read The Stranger. But I wonder if you think, you know, he's been dead now for how many years?
He died in 1960.
He died in 1960.
So he's about to celebrate the 50th mm-hmm. anniversary of his death.
Does he remain, him, his philosophy, his writings, do they remain relevant to this day, this era?
I think they do. And I didn't know how popular he was with kids or how current it was. Although if you go to the internet, there are thousands and thousands of sites and blogs and pictures. And he's even, somebody put him on Facebook, which is always curious. But what impressed me about him most in the end is what I think is most relevant. And I think those who know him and those who read him feel this instantly, which is his remarkable, really astonishing honesty, his need to say what is what, to speak. He has a line from his Nobel speech where he says, you know, it's the important thing is not to tell lies. and his moral vigilance, which is what got him into trouble. But when he felt that there was something like Stalinism or different sides had taken the Algerian War, he was very explicit about it, and he stood up.
One of the other things that strikes you when you read your book is, while he's writing about the big issues of his day and issues that remain important in our day, he is in many ways very private, quite intentionally so, it seems like, this sense of reserve. That must have made it harder for you in trying to explore his life, figure things out.
I also had moments where I wondered if I was being intrusive. I mean, you do get very involved with the possible feelings of your new friend. And knowing the French have had the word pudeur, which is always applied to him, which is a combination of reserve and modesty and decency and prudence, and that really is untranslatable. And that was the word that described him probably most clearly. One of his children said it was his pudeur. His other child said it was his sense of fraternity that absolutely defined him. But given that, you wondered, am I going too far? Is this a good idea? How do I respect this guy's pudeur and at the same time find out what's going on with all these women? Or read too deeply into his notebooks and try and match them up with what he's doing. But I did. I did, and I, you know, but I would monitor myself, being a little bit that way myself.
We're talking with Elizabeth Hawes about her new book. It's called Camus, A Romance. We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we'll go to some of the callers we've got hanging on already. We have some open lines, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about Camus, A Romance. It's a new book, both a biography and a memoir by Elizabeth Hawes, who joins me in the studio. Well, let's take some calls from our listeners. We'll go first to Maple Heights, Ohio, and talk to Frank. Frank, thank you for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. Love listening to the program. I have a basic question as far as to the soul of the man, and as far as writers, I'm a poet myself, and I enjoy basically learning of new men and how they write, and could you describe him in a way, because I've never heard of him before?
Sure. Big, complicated personality, but a man probably most notable for his honesty, his responsibility, his moral vigilance through the times, his constancy. But as a writer, a man of various styles. In fact, he wanted to write all his books in different styles. As a youth, he wrote very poetically. He writes this lyric, which is when he's speaking really from his heart, particularly about Algeria. He writes very lyric prose, very sensual prose. He was profoundly connected to the sea and the sand and the sun of his native land, and was a resource for him, carried him through always. He was also connected to the poverty of his youth, which he always said was the glue that stuck to his soul. I think he's a wonderful read. It is fun to see the different styles as well, a very short, rather choppy style in The Stranger, until the main character makes the connection with humanity, and then it sort of smooths out, you know, a much more sort of rational, long-winded, somewhat oppressed style in the plague, which is under a quarantine and everybody's trapped. And essays that are both lyric and just, you know, addressing an issue as well, moral.
Here's an email we've gotten. This person writes, I first fell in love with Camus when I came across my still favorite quote. Quote, in the depth of winter, I finally learned that within me there lay an invincible summer. I try to include famous and inspirational quotes on my company's product packaging, and I have received many comments about that quote on our grapefruit mint organic soap over the years. What would Camus have thought about his quote being on grapefruit mint organic soap?
He would have laughed. He would not have been annoyed, I don't think. One of the things about Camus that is very little known is that he had a wonderful sense of humor, and he loved language, and he loved to be ironic. He loved puns. He loved to make up names for people. He named his cars. He named his animals things like cigarette or Kali and Gula for the play Caligula that he was working hard on. But he would have loved it. And that was my quote, too. That was the quote that really got me in college, that was probably at the very beginning of this whole project. In fact, I found the index card that I, in my very girlish and correct hand, that I had written, au milieu d'hiver, you know, et cetera.
Now, you've read his work both in English and in French, in the original French.
Yes.
Is, on some authors, when their work is translated, elements of it are lost. They don't translate so well. What is the case with Camus, do you think, having read him in both languages?
Well, I do prefer him in French, and I read him most in French, and I often had to go this time to read him in English, partly because I had to quote in English, and I had to quote the quotes that have been published in English, not my quotes, unfortunately, because I love to translate myself. I think his different styles show much more in the French. But of course, the French may be much more attuned to that than Americans in general. I think it showed, particularly there was a biography that came out in the 90s written by a Frenchman that was then translated into English. I mean, it was a very exhaustive, it was the first authorized biography, and it was translated into English, and it was just an entirely different matter. Not only different language that just was somewhat annoying, but it had cut all the good stuff about Paris intellectuals and the Algerian War, thinking that Americans didn't know anything about it. And that's slightly off the point, but it isn't. I mean, it reflects on Camus, too.
Let's talk to Joe. He's calling us from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Joe, thank you for giving us a call.
Thank you. It's a great show. I wanted an opinion on what his feelings would be about international terrorism and what his ideas might be on how you would deal with it.
All right, Joe, thanks for your call.
He was very early coming out against terrorism. He thought he understood terrorism as this last desperate act. Could see it in Algeria. He had been very young trying to fight when he was first trying to fight for rights in Algeria and writing about it as a journalist as well, and had in fact joined the Communist Party. He was recruiting Muslims for, you know, the Communist Party before they turned away from being pro-nationalist Arab to backing France in trying to retain prevent the independence of Algeria. But I just forgot where I was going.
Well, you were talking about what he would have thought
yes.
about terrorism today.
He wrote, I think he would condemn it. I think he would say that this reckless taking of human life is just unacceptable. I think that's what he was saying during the Algerian War that eventually got him into trouble. He made a statement against, in his Nobel speech, against terrorism, condemning the terrorism that, you know, was killing people so idly in the streets, and mentioned in that he had always condemned terrorism, but he could not condemn a terrorism that could take away the life of his mother and his family in Algeria, and was, you know, criticized dramatically for that at that point.
He said in that Nobel Prize speech, quote, I believe in justice, but I will defend my mother before justice.
Yes.
And what do you think he meant by that?
I think he meant he would defend his mother. I think he was coming out against the justice of terrorism as opposed to justice.
And why was it so controversial that he said this?
He, by that time, was in big trouble anyway in terms of the Algerian War, because he had tried, he believed that everything should be done right up until the last moment to try and keep it a country of two nations. He was very much for a federal system, which was the only thing he could think of that would preserve, you know, both countries in equal rights under some sort of French cap. By the time he really came out for it, and he did, went back to Algeria and gave a very famous appeal for a civil truce, it really was too late in most people's minds. All the different bills that he had backed in the French legislature to just give the Arabs a few more rights had failed, and the Arabs had, world had been neglected during World War II, etc. So, but after that, and then he did write extensively for L'Express, mainly to address the Algerian situation. But he felt like it was just making it more complicated, and he finally, and it was getting nowhere, and he finally dropped out and was quiet, felt that he'd just add to the trouble by continuing to advocate certain things for him, and he said he just could not take sides for one. That had gotten him into terrific trouble at a moment where everybody was coming around to back, you know, anti-colonialism and the independence of Algeria.
You talked about his book, The First Man, which was so autobiographical, and he dedicated that book to his mother, quote, "to you who will never be able to read this book." So his mother was illiterate?
His mother, who really was in many ways the center of his life and remained it, and he continued to see her as often as he could and had a profound love for her, felt that she had given him, as he says, my most lofty lessons in forbearance and innocence and patience and kindness. But she was mute, or nearly mute, nearly deaf, illiterate, so that she couldn't read a newspaper or listen to the radio, and certainly couldn't read his work. And that's what, you know, that's what that was addressing. He felt that they were bound together in this, you know, that she had influenced his life so dramatically, that he was seeking for the happiness that she hadn't had.
Let's go to another caller. We'll go to Richard. He's calling us from Massachusetts. Hi, Richard.
Oh, hi, Susan. Thank you very much. Earlier in the relationship with Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre, they seem to got along fairly well. And I was wondering if you could tell me what made the estrangement bitter? Was it philosophical difference about politics or Algeria? And also, could you tell me if he had any children?
All right, Richard, thanks for your call.
I'll get rid of the first one first, because it's shorter, which is, yes, he had twins, actually, a boy and a girl, with his second wife, Francine. And I did get to meet them both, which was very good. They're not too much younger than I am, so that, in a weird and wonderful way, put me almost into that generation and almost into a relationship. In terms of Sartre, they had had a wonderful time together. They met, they had actually reviewed each other's first books long before they met. Sartre had reviewed The Stranger in very glowing terms before Camus ever got to France. And then they met right away, just by chance, when he got to France. And it was occupation, it was wartime, and they had a wild and woolly and wonderful time socializing together. They were bound together, not only in this desperate fun, which was a denial of wartime, but also in their feelings and hopes for a new future, and in this movement, which had not yet been defined as existentialism. That came afterward in some events. And Camus would later say he wasn't an existentialist, but he really was in certainly in practice, and certainly at that point. But he had very different feelings about where it had come from, and he certainly, in terms of existence before essence, would have taken it the opposite way. And he also felt that you had to move beyond this existentialism into some sort of action. And that's, you know, all his feelings about life being happy and life being worth, you know, what you put into it, was a much stronger thing than Sartre's belief. Sartre was a systematic thinker. Camus was just a writer who was a thinker. But they came to blows over Stalinism, basically. There had been little differences, and they'd been, you know, Sartre was annoyed by what he called Camus' insistent, and later he said insufferable, moralism. And when Stalin hung in there for a long, long time with Stalinism, and Camus could not any longer, he was condemning revolutionary violence and violence of any sort very early on. He had met Kessler when he first came to New York, which confirmed all his feelings about the Soviet Union. And he came out first in essays and then the rebel against totalitarianism. And that was when the real break was, and the book was attacked, mainly for its ideas, but also for what a poor thinker Camus was in The Rebel and in public. And it's savagely. I mean, it's painful to read these letters now. I mean, painful, because Camus as a man was attacked. And it did him in for a while.
Now, before that period, you mentioned he was in France during World War II. What was he doing during the German occupation of France?
Well, he went to France by accident, in a way. He hadn't intended to necessarily. He was living in Algeria, and he was teaching, and he had started a theater. He loved the theater. But he had TB that he had developed at 17 and that plagued him all his life in very, very serious ways. Plague is too mild. But he had to go to France. He had a new bout of TB. He had to go to France to go to get away from the humid coast of Algeria. And he went over and found this place that cousin owned high in the Haute-Loire, where he was staying. And it was during that time that the Allied landing took place in Algeria. It was that November. It was November 1942. He had gone over the summer of 42 and cut him off from Algeria, from his new wife, Francine. And he continued there, but as it was, he was landed very near the center of the resistance, near Saint-Étienne and Chambon-sur-Lignon. And I don't think he knew everything that was going on, but most of his friends were very involved in the resistance. It wasn't until he got to France that he was directly involved. He became the editor of the underground newspaper Combat, which was a life force for the underground, and which became, after liberation, became a daily that was above ground, and became the voice of the future of France. And here was this young 30-year-old who had been there in France for a year, running it, the voice.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Elk Rapids, Michigan. I don't know quite where that is, and talk to Gordon. Gordon, where is Elk Rapids?
It's just north of Traverse City, about 15 miles.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling us.
Yes, one of my favorite authors, an existentialist, even though he may say he isn't. this is great. I'm a philosopher. That was my major in college. And Camus was my favorite writer by far. You were right, about Sartre. Sartre was a phenomenologist, and, mm-hmm. Boy, Camus was quite a writer. Words were important to him, but feeling and meaning and existence was most important. My favorite work is The Myth of Sisyphus, because he asked the question about meaning, that the most important question one must ask is whether or not to commit suicide, and that has to do with the meaning in your life. If your life has no meaning, he eventually came up with an answer, which, as you said, was to rebel, to become the rebel. Anyway, he's my favorite. Thanks for having this program.
Oh, fun. I wish we could talk more.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for your call. Now, that's Gordon's favorite writing by Camus. What is yours?
I still think The Stranger is a gem, a real gem. And I like The Plague. My favorite books probably are The Stranger and The First Man, but they're essays that I love. The essays in Summer, which was written in 1954 when he was going back to this lyric style of his youth, as well as really exploring where he wanted to go, are wonderful essays. And very little known are a series of short stories he wrote under Resistance, Rebellion, and Death. I'm sorry, and The Exile and the Kingdom, that most of them set in Algeria, that were so-called experimental short stories.
He came to the United States right after the war in 1946. How was he received here?
Royally and with great excitement, I mean, at least among academics. He had not been heard of. He was here really for the publication of The Stranger, which was fun to read about. I'm fun to read of his own book party on the roof of the Astor Hotel and his radio interviews and meeting young girls who flocked around him and whatever. But he had a wonderful time. He was here 3 months. He both got America and he didn't get America. He loved to walk the streets. He loved Harlem. He had, biting but well-intended remarks about the blacks and how they were the passion of the city as far as he could see. But he was dying to go home by the end.
You say that he kept going to the zoo in New York.
Yes.
Why did he keep going back to
well,
the zoo?
Well, he did love animals, and he liked the sort of public scene. He loved little stories. He loved the odd detail. But he had many cats and dogs. And it's funny, when I went, finally got to interview his daughter, who is the executrix and sort of the holds all the keys to the kingdom in terms of wanting, you know, permission to do research. And I was terribly excited about this interview that I'd worked for a year and a half to get. And the first thing I met when I went up the steps and in the door were these two huge dogs. And during the course of the interview, I'd ask a question, and the dogs would bark, and that's all I'd hear on my tape that night.
Oh, no. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Albert Camus, and we'll go back to the phones and take your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a prescription for healthcare reform. We talk with Maggie Mahar, who writes the HealthBeat blog and is author of Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much. Also, Armando Iannucci, director of the new political satire In the Loop. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're talking this hour with Elizabeth Hawes, who joins me in the studio. She's written a book called Camus, A Romance. And we've had one email asking me to spell the name of the author that we're talking about, and it's spelled C-A-M-U-S. We talked before the break about the role he played in France during the World War II. Here's an emailer, David, who writes us from Kent, Ohio, who says, "My mother's family is from Paris. Her father was active in the French underground during the war and was tasked with recovering art and antiquity stolen by the Nazis. He was also supposedly friends with Jean-Paul Sartre and involved in an underground newspaper that eventually got him excommunicated from the Catholic Church." Now, would that have been the newspaper you were talking about? And what would have been the relationship with the Catholic Church?
There were a number of underground newspapers. I don't know what would have, other than there was a paper called, there were two, three other big ones. The main other one, I think, was called, it was a Masonic paper. It was called Franc-Tireur. But I don't know. I mean, I could venture some guesses.
What would your guess, would there be an obvious guess?
No, mm-hmm. And not in my mind.
All right. Well, David, I'm sorry we don't have a clearer answer for you there. G.K. from Dallas has written us and writes, "I attended a French high school in the 70s and spent many hours reading and studying Camus. I love his work, and I have always been fascinated by the myth of Sisyphus and its famous sentence, quote, 'One has to imagine Sisyphus as being happy.' Tell us about that sentence."
Well, it sums up Camus, and, you know, response to the absurd, you know, what he defined as the absurd, which is basically limits on man's hopes and the contrast between what he wants and what he really can get in life that's promised. But it is, I mean, he really felt that the main message, that the conclusion you had to, after you had examined everything about it, gone through the pain of realizing that there wasn't necessarily any form of redemption, and that life had its difficulties and all, that the only answer you could come up with, it was, a dignified answer, was that, you know, life was worth living, and there was happiness. And when he says, you must imagine Sisyphus happy, and people say, what? Happy? You're rolling that rock up the hill.
But we are all Sisyphus.
We are all, and every day. It's funny, people would say to me, people I didn't know, when they'd hear what I was doing and who I was writing about, a couple of people said to me, oh, you poor thing, all those years in the darkness with that dark man. And in fact, Camus was an extraordinarily hopeful person and a very positive man, and he was sort of irrepressible in his own joys on Earth.
He won the Nobel Prize in 1957, one of the youngest people ever to win.
Second youngest at that point.
Who was the youngest?
Kipling was a year younger.
But it was not all good news for him. What was the impact of that? What happened with the Nobel Prize award?
It really was a disaster for him, as he said. He had been, after this huge fallout with Jean-Paul Sartre, and having been attacked publicly and savagely for what he had written, and his poor thinking, as Sartre said, in the Rebel, as well as his own, you know, insistent moralism in public, the whole intellectual left sort of piled on against him. And then there was a series of other troubles that followed. His wife had a nervous breakdown, which he felt somewhat responsible for because he was a great womanizer, although he loved his wife. And then the Algerian War began and became extremely difficult for him. He found it impossible to take sides, although he had always agitated and worked hard for Arab rights. And then as a result of all the above, he was going through this period of writer's block. I mean, years and years of writer's block. It was only, at the time of the Nobel Prize, he had published one book, which was The Fall, which was basically, and in large part, a response to Sartre, because it was about judgment and getting back at him, and Sartre knew it. So he really felt that he hadn't written, and he was going to change. He was going to write much more experimentally, and he hadn't gotten there. And here comes the Nobel Prize, as his decline seemed very clear. And, of course, the intellectual left immediately chortled and said, yes, the Nobel Prize is only awarded for a finished work. You are finished. You are complete. You're not going to write anything else. And he was hoping to get going, and he really said, someone who was with him at the time said he looked like he was suffocating when he first about it. He thought Melrose should have won it.
Who was
the other candidate, who was probably the runner-up.
And was a poet.
And was a novelist.
Novelist.
And later became Minister of Culture under de Gaulle and all that. But he had written some very important novels earlier than Camus and had influenced Camus, I think. And he thought about refusing it, or at least just sending a speech. And eventually he went with his wife and with the whole entourage from even his American publisher. And he gave a speech, but in the speech he did refer to the panic that was his greatest, you know, response, and the fact that he felt very modest and he wasn't finished and he felt unworthy, and he accepted it in the name of Algeria and the thrill of being, you know, honored as a French Algerian writer. But he also took the moment to say, you know, that art, you know, that you had to go on with art. It wasn't necessarily a private thing, that you had to, art was, you know, refusing to lie about things, about which he was referring to the Algerian War, too, and the Rebel. Therefore, he could not just, you know, hang in there in just solitude, and he accepted.
What did he do with the big cash prize?
He bought a house in the country that he had wanted. He wanted to get away from Paris. He realized, he thought he would go back to Algeria, always, and he didn't, but the closest he could come was Provence. And he had been looking for a house, but he bought a house, and they moved in the year before he died, and was writing well on this new book.
Let's go to Seattle, Washington, and talk to Lauren. Lauren, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
I had a question for your guest, and my question was, I just finished up my undergraduate degree in philosophy and came to know Camus through that in an existentialism course. Of course, I read The Stranger, and that's the part that I fell in love with Camus, the rational side that he gains by the end of the book. And I was just kind of curious if you could maybe suggest perhaps a book of his that displays a different writing style than the philosophical, rational side that would be a good transition into his literary work.
Well, I always think The First Man is a good combo with any of his books just because it takes you really into the soul of Albert Camus. It's, it was meant to be an epic novel of some 900 pages, and it was less than 200 pages and was just transparently autobiographical as it was published 35 years after his death. And it tells the story of his childhood in Algeria. But, you know, all the founding elements of Camus, all the things that were important to him, all the what he refers to as the glue that stuck to his soul, you know, are there, and you understand a lot where the philosophy came from. I think some of the stories, too. There's a collection of essays called Summer, in which he talks about, much more personally, he returns to the really lyric style of his youth, which is very, very affecting, and is out, you know, is present too in The First Man. But he also talks about changing. He talks about his writing. He talks about his beliefs and his philosophy. A little bit about the sort of hedonism and the, you know, attachment to the earth. To the, you know, he really felt that the world was beautiful, and outside of it, there was no salvation, and there was no point spending anything. Any time on anything but the world. But he also said, you know, he said when he was asked about existentialism, he said, if I'm an existentialist, it doesn't necessarily go, as, you know, in hand that I'm an atheist. I cannot be called an atheist.
Oh, so he was not an atheist?
He was not an atheist.
Was he devout?
Well, he was devout about man. He certainly had a, you know, in his humanity. I don't think there's a whole debate among clerics. About whether or not he was eventually going to convert to Catholicism. And in The First Man, for example, his characters, Jacques Commeret, who's referred to as J.C., Jésus-Christ, and there are a number of other J.C.s in the novel before the fall, and he was going to call First Man Adam originally, and you thought, what's going on here? But maybe he would have converted and 20 years. I doubt it. I think it was a different sort of religion.
Lauren, thanks so much for Lauren, thanks so much for your call. We'll go now to Duncanville, Texas. Mary Alice has been holding on. Hi, Mary Alice.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. My question is, when I was in high school in 1970, I went to the library and checked out The Stranger. My father was a professor of philosophy, and I was intrigued by it, and the librarian looked at me really strangely, and the next thing I knew, several hours later, I was being called into the principal's office for reading that particular book. And we got into a spirited debate, myself and the principal. And I still remember that so clearly, and that really led me to read more of his works. But I wonder how you would comment on why people felt threatened by him and his writings, because I was so flabbergasted that you know, was called on the carpet for reading that particular book.
All right, Mary Alice, thanks for that memory.
I think certainly with A Stranger, and certainly to someone who didn't understand it or really get into what was happening at the end, I mean, I think you look at, you know, this, you know, sudden murder, the lack of remorse for his mother's death, this unfeeling, immoral man in the eyes of certainly conventional or religious thinkers, and then his refusal, you know, the final mysterious line. I mean, still mysterious to a lot of people. You certainly, everyone has their own answer.
What is the final line?
Which is, well, it's that he hopes he's facing execution, and he just hopes so. He's happy, and he hopes there'll be a large crowd.
And what do you think that means? How do you interpret that last line?
Well, that the large crowd, I mean, you know, Camus really was saying that man has to love his own fate. And Meursault, the character in this case, who has been totally outside society, has had no relation to his actions, no sense of, you know, action and sequence or consequence. And he does get that in the end. I mean, after he's murdered, when he's in jail. And there's this wonderful scene where it's night and he's looking up and he opens up to the night and the stars and he's moved and, you know, and weeps at the beauty of it all, really, and at the meaning of it all, and obviously honors his life such as it's been.
Here's an email from Orgo, who writes, I grew up in India, where the stranger isn't as commonplace in high schools as in many countries of the West. However, a friend's dad, who was a political science professor, referred the stranger to me when I was 15, and I fell in love deeply and forever. That's why when you use the word love, it feels just right, a deep platonic love. I still have the famous photograph of Camus on the wall of my little grad student room in Baltimore, and it makes the room a little better every time I look at it.
It's probably the same photo I had back in my college room.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now, here we have another email from Frank, who says, why hasn't a decent movie been made of The Stranger? Is that true? Has there not been a decent movie made from The Stranger?
There has been one movie made that I know of, and it took me years to get to see it. First of all, I couldn't find it. It was made by De Sica, the Italian, in the 60s. And it starred Marcello Mastroianni as Merceau. He, at that point, I believe, was in his 50s. He was rather aging Merceau, who's supposed to be 24, 25. And Anna Karenina. And I couldn't play it. I finally bought a new fancy DVD player so I could see it. And it's okay. It's fun. It's fun. And maybe someone will make one. I heard that somebody had made a movie of The Plague starring, it was Caligula I just heard about. Sorry, that stars Helen Mirren and John Gielgud recently. So, I mean, I think we all have to get on the internet and find them. But there were supposed to be movies made, and then he died. One of them was supposed to star him.
Owen from Jacksonville, Florida, writes an email. Early in the program, you discussed whether Camus' work still enjoys a presence among young people. It does, thanks in part to indie rock music. Next to perhaps Charles Bukowski, Camus has to be the most referenced author in the genre. Is that right? Has he mentioned a lot of indie rock songs?
I wish we could. Could we get back the email person? Because he was answered immediately. I can't tell you. I know he does pop up. It's when I was writing this, I just was astonished at where he popped up. In songs, yes. I can't tell you which one, so I'm afraid.
Brian has been very patient holding on. Brian, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for holding on. He's calling us from Wimberley, Texas. Please go ahead.
Okay, thanks. You kind of indirectly answered the question that I was going to ask. Specifically, what I was going to ask is the role that the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche played in Camus' thought. And what I have in mind is how Camus understood modernity and the uniqueness of modernity vis-a-vis Nietzsche.
I'm not sure I entirely understand the question,
Okay. Well, of course, you know, you were right in your discussion about Sisyphus being happy and Camus' conclusions about the absurdity of life and just accepting life. Of course, all of this is just standard Nietzschean fare. But all of these writers, Camus, Nietzsche, Sartre, they all looked at the modern condition as unique. In other words, you know, prior to modernity, people looked at the world in a different way. And there's a way that in modern times we can't look at the world. And, of course, a lot of these writers took that from Nietzsche. And I was just wondering if you had given very much thought to that.
I think Camus certainly did, or certainly thought about it with him. He was a great hero of his. He read him. He's referenced all the time. He's really present in the notebooks. Some of it was often because Nietzsche was sick. He didn't have TB. But he wrote very well about illness as well, and Camus used to turn to him for a sort of support there. But in terms of Camus, I think it was also the condition of the 20th century. It was the wars and the nihilism that, you know, was even more than you get in Nietzsche that defined modernity, and certainly true for Sartre as well.
All right, Brian, thanks for your call. Just very briefly, we're almost out of time. Do you feel that he influenced your own life?
Yes, well, he did provide all those answers back in that sophomore year where, you know, losing your faith and your bearings and everything else. And in that sense, it was that I could replace it. I didn't even have to give up faith. And I still do have a rather abstracted faith, but his very particular version of humanity.
Humanity. Yeah. Elizabeth Haas, thank you so much for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show to talk about your book, Camus, A Romance.
Thank you so much.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.